Well, let's talk about first last week's exercise on the chi-square. I try to make it a habit of just briefly touching on last exercise. And well, let me share screen for that. And here's the case. If you recall, it was the chi-square. And the chi-square is the way we get a probability on a fit. And it's not the probability of the fit being correct. It's the probability of having this chi-square or something higher, meaning or worse, given that data and theory are in fact compatible. Which means when that probability, when the chi-square gets very high and the probability hence gets very low, then you might think, okay, either I was very unlucky or something is wrong. Usually the fit hypothesis. And that's when you reject it, and we'll get more to that. One of the things I wanted you to look at here was the fact that, well, if we do the fit 100 times, a 1,000 times, and we generate data and fit it, well, then the mean comes out to be 3.62 here. Well, that's lucky, because otherwise our fit would be biased. We'll come back to that. And then you might say, well, it's a little off. Well, but we can look at the standard deviation at 0.7. Is that good or bad? Well, it's good because that corresponds well to what we got in one fit here. So that's quite reasonable that it has that value. It should have that value. And if we divide this by square root of 1,000, then we get the uncertainty on the mean. Recall that. So this is the uncertainty from one example. And well, if we divide by square root of 1,000, which is approximately 30, then we get 0.02 and a little, which means this is within one sigma of the mean. Great. One should be very happy to see these numbers. And like, yeah. And likewise, in the second case, we see that 0.3 was what it was generated with and comes out to be just slightly below. 0.12 for the uncertainty. Yes, that looks about right. Then there was the distribution here, which, and the question about why is this flat? Well, note this is not a fit. What we do is we have a problem and we and it has 7 degrees of freedom. And from that, we just look at the distribution of chi-squares we get from the problem. And on top, I've drawn the chi-square distribution for 7 degrees of freedom. And Kimmy, would you please mute? And well, and the two correspond. And that's, again, fortunate, otherwise there was something wrong. And when you have a distribution and you draw a random number from it and then plot the integral from that number and up, why the integral? Well, that's what corresponds to this chi-square value or something worse. Well, then you get a uniform distribution. And that means if all works well, you should expect p-values to have a uniform distribution. I'll get back to what other distributions it can have and discuss the course, but it should be uniform. And that means that when you get a p-value of, say, 10%, well, 1 in 10 should give that, and there shouldn't be anything suspicious about that. You can easily be unlucky in 1 in 10. If it gets to 1 per mil, this is when you should say, ah, I'm unlucky, but I'm rarely that unlucky. Hence, you should mentally say, all right, probably something went on here. There is actually what we didn't go through in Friday's example was chi-square test several examples. And the several examples case is one where we don't try one type of fit, but we actually try many. So we try the line fit. So, but we also try another fit, one with oscillations. And finally, a fit that is of a histogram instead of points, and which is an exponential. And in all three cases, do we draw the chi-square that comes out from repeating it 1,000 times? And this time we draw the chi-square distribution for 17 degrees of freedom. And that is because each of these problems have 17 degrees of freedom in them, even if they're very different. They have different fitting, number of fitting parameters and so on. But the point is, it doesn't matter. The chi-square don't care. It cares about how many degrees of freedom, not what the problem is. And then the chi-square should distribute it accordingly. And it does. Very nice to see. And that is why we can get a fit probability. Tomorrow, we'll play with the likelihood. And then we'll see that while the likelihood has many advantages, this is not one of them. All right. And with that, I'll go to today's lecture, which is on probability density functions. Were there any questions regarding last week's exercise? And I can say we'll post example solutions later today. No, you can think about them or you can write them in the chat if you feel like it. Well, at least it makes sense now. Cool. Probability density functions. Well, where are we here? We are in a place where, well, any event can distribute itself according to any distribution, you could say. However, there are quite a few of these which repeat themselves. For example, we saw that the Gaussian distribution, also called the normal distribution, came from the central limit theorem. So this is, of course, a distribution that will come upon again and again and again and again. This is, you know, plays a central role. But there are others, exponential, uniform, and Poisson and binomial. We've discussed the uniform, at least, and touched upon the exponential. Today, we'll touch more on the binomial and Poisson. And they are different because they are discrete and not continuous. Now, all of these so-called probability density functions, they feed into both testing and into the chi-square and fitting. Because we have data and we want to model it with something, and that something is PDFs or functions in general. But the PDF is thinking about, well, if the fallout, you know, a PDF, for example, rolling a die. First of all, it's discrete. You can only get 1 to 6. And there is 1/6 probability for each. And the total probability is, of course, 1. And so every occurrence has sort of a probability density function. Now, you can imagine how to do that when the how you can sum up the probabilities when it's discrete. But typically, probability density functions are actually continuous. And what do they describe? Well, they describe the probability to observe X in the interval around X. Well, that is proportional to the width of the interval and this function, which is what we call the probability density function. So they should, of course, be normalized. If you integrate over a PDF, you should get 1. Why? Well, that's because the total probability should come out to 1. Something is going to happen. And what about expectation value and variance? Well, it's much like what we do with ordinary numbers, you could say. Instead of doing a sum of X, now we take an integral where we weigh things according to the probability density function of X. And for the variance, we do the same thing. Now it's not just X, now it's X minus the mean squared. And here there's not 1 over n or 1 over n minus 1, simply because, well, here we assume that we know the PDF perfectly. So let's consider one PDF, namely the uniform, which we had before. So this can be written in this way. And if we do the integral of that, we're going to get one. And if we do the integral and weighed by x, well, then we get 1/2. And if we want the variance, well, we get 1/12. And that was the reason why in the first exercise with the central limit theorem that there was a square root 1/12 in there, simply because that was a way to normalize the unit distribution in order to have a standard deviation of 1. Now, this is one PDF. Here is, well, a list of some of the PDFs. This is from Wikipedia, and I would say there are surely more. But this just goes to show how many different types of PDFs there are. And we will not go through even a small fraction of them. I'll list in a moment those I even think are relevant to the degree that you should know them by heart. But there are really a ton. And think of all of these as you need a distribution which has the integral 1, which means the distribution will have to start at 0 and then have some shape and then end at 0 again. Otherwise, it's not going to have an integral of 1. So, but apart from that, there are many options. And I think another place where you can actually find a list, a good list of PDFs, is actually the SciPy reference in stats, because there they have a whole list of them, again, with good descriptions. Though I think still Wikipedia wins out in the descriptions. All right, and then comes this quote that I've been also using on the webpage. Essentially, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And this is by the British statistician, George Box. And I've had the privilege of meeting him, but I particularly love the quote, because in reality, nothing is even Gaussianly distributed. Nothing follows these PDFs exactly. They only follow them approximatively. And as long as we don't have infinite statistics, we might be lucky enough that, say, a chi-square probability comes out nicely, meaning that given the statistics, we can't see a difference between the data and the PDFs that we've used to describe them. But if there is enough statistics, then surely the real world has complications, which makes it hard to model. And so that's why all models are essentially wrong, but some are useful. And that is because when we manage to make a fit with one or a combination of these functions, and it actually fits, and all the other hypotheses do not fit, then it tells us a great deal about the underlying mechanisms behind the data that we see. So that's the sort of point of these PDFs. Once we know what this type of process does, this type of process does, then we can see to what degree it fits the data we have. And that goes for anything, as long as we understand what's behind them. And well, I can say from DNA, I once did with Eske Willerslev's group some ancient DNA, and I said, this should be Poisson distributed. And I plotted a Poisson, and clearly there was a Poisson in it, but at very high values it didn't fit, and at very low values it didn't fit. There, something else was going on, but it still gave the insight. Okay, mainly this is a Poisson process. I'll come back to what that is. And then there's something going on at very long reads and very short reads. All right. I said that I would list those PDFs that I think you should know. And here's the list. It's relatively short. You need to know the Gaussian, of course. And then the Poisson and the binomial are two others. Those are the two discrete ones we'll discuss today. Then there's the student's T distribution, which is almost a Gaussian, but with longer tails from when you don't know the variance. In a Gaussian, we know the variance, but remember, if you were four persons who measured something, then you could only estimate the variance from the number of measurements that you made, and it's not a very good estimate of the variance, and hence you don't know, even if you fit it with a Gaussian, you don't know that it fits that. And actually here the student's T distribution steps in. There's the uniform distribution, there's the chi-square distribution, where I don't want you to know the formula, I just want you to know the shape of it and the fact that we use it for the chi-square test. There's the exponential, and then there's the error function, which is the integral of the Gaussian. And this is not a PDF, it's an integral of a PDF. And this is simply used for turning a number of sigmas into a probability. All right, so let's start with the binomial. Well, a binomial is the distribution you get when you have n trials, each with p chance of success. How many successes, small n, should you then expect in total? And this could be flipping a coin 10 times. In fact, shown here is exactly the distribution you should expect when flipping a coin 10 times. Probability of success, well, I don't know what you define as success, but it doesn't matter because there's 50-50 and you do it 10 times. And you should, of course, expect 5 successes and very rarely 10 successes. And this is described by the binomial distribution, which says, well, the probability of a success is P and I need that N times. So that enters here. But of course, for the rest of them, I want a failure or non-success. So that has probability 1 minus P. And how many times do I need that? Well, the rest of the times. So capital N minus small n. And this would give, this usually gives a very small number. But the thing is that you can in many different ways obtain this result. How many? Binomial coefficient in front. And there you have the distribution. And if you do a sum, here it's not an integral. Well, you could make it an integral. If you do a sum over these, then it doesn't matter what capital N and small n and P are. You get a sum of 1. So yeah, it's normalized. And the binomial distribution has a mean of n times p. Does that make sense? Well, if we throw a coin 10 times and the probability of success is a half, well, we multiply the two to get what we would expect. So that's 5. All right, and the variance turns out to be n times p times 1 minus p. And well, how can you see that? Well, it has to be symmetric in P around a half, because this only depends on how you define success. So for example, if the success rate is 20%, well, then you get a binomial centered around 2. If the success rate is 80%, well, you would get the same one mirrored at 5 turned around. And so it would have to look like this. And if you juggle this around, you say, well, I want the uncertainty. Then you take the square root, you know, the standard deviation. But what you often encounter is that you encounter a fraction, small n out of capital N. And for that, the uncertainty on the fraction is square root of the fraction times 1 minus the fraction. That's sort of this term, divided by n, and then square root the whole thing. And that formula is derived just from up here. There's nothing magic about it. In fact, what I do is I say, well, I have a fraction n over capital N. Small n has the variance here. And so if I want the sigma of that, then I just take the square root, and then I divide it by n because capital N is constant. And that's where the n goes into the denominator. as a square root. And there you have it. But that means whenever you have a fraction, you can calculate the standard deviation, the uncertainty on it. And this translates very easily. So let's say you count 100 red cars on Blydom's right, and you see 15 red cars. What is your estimate of the probability of red cars and the uncertainty? And so here, I could have made that into a poll, but I wanted to spare you this morning. So here are the options, and clearly it's, well, this, and I've taken the liberty of putting two digits on significant digits just to be able to see a difference between some of these. And if you punch in this number here, well, what do you get? You get 0.036. And so if a friend tells you that 8% of cars on Blydenswy are red, do you believe that's right? Well, here we get already into hypothesis testing. You would say, this is what we measure. This is the hypothesis. How many sigmas are we away? And then you turn that into a probability and you ask, is that too small so that I reject it or not? So that's, of course, how we use the errors. Now, what are the requirements for a binomial? Well, first of all, you need a number of fixed trials. You can't just say, whenever I have 15 cars, I'm going to stop. No, you need to do the counting of 100 and decide on that. And they need to be independent. And only two outcomes, success or failure. If there are more outcomes, it's just a multinomial distribution. And it, of course, has to be a constant probability. So those are the requirements. And so tossing a coin 20 times, looking for tails, should be binomial distributed. Asking 200 people if they watch sports on TV. Rolling a die to see if a six appear. And that would be multinomial if we cared about all outcomes, but now it's just a six or not. And even if we ask 100 diehards from Enhedslisten, a left-wing party, if they would vote conservative in the next election, that's still a binomial. What is not a binomial if you roll a die until a six appears, because now capital N is not fixed. Or if you draw five cards for a poker hand, for example, if there's no replacement, then it's not independent. Once you've taken a club, the next one has a smaller chance of being a club. And so, well, it's not independent or the probability changes. Now, that's about it. And people used this distribution a lot and said, we understand all these things. One of the challenges that comes about is calculating this, because when N gets high, this becomes cumbersome. This is hard to calculate. Factorials are notoriously difficult. And so while we're in these numbers, it should be all right. But already N50, well, 50 factorial is not a nice number to calculate. But it turned out that, and this was Poisson who found out, that using something called Stirling's formula, you can make it simple in a certain case. If N goes to infinity, but P goes to zero, then is this defined? Well, if N times P goes towards some value, lambda, then the binomial approaches a Poisson distribution, which looks like this. Note, one got rid of the factorial. And then you might say there's a factorial here. Yeah, that's just for the number of outcomes. This means that capital N can become a billion, and you don't have to do a billion factorial. You might just be looking for, well, how often should I expect 20 from this process? Well, that can be calculated. And this approximation is already quite good for N equals 50 and P equals 0.1. Now, the Poisson distribution is fantastic because it only has one parameter, lambda. And the mean is lambda. Not surprising, right? For the binomial, it was N times P that was the the mean. But the variance is also lambda. Again, not too surprising, because the variance for the binomial is given here. And as p goes to zero, this term disappeared. We have n times p, and hence the variance is lambda. But the consequence of this is that the error on a Poisson number is the square root of that number. This is immensely important. Memorize. Now, I'm going to repeat it. This error on a Poisson number is the square root of that number. All right. And this is useful for many things. For example, when you have a histogram, you might ask, well, I have some amount in one bin, some number of counts in one bin. What uncertainty do I assign it? The square root of that number, because the chance of ending up in a specific bin is low, but there are many put into a histogram. Well, that's an assumption. So capital N is high. And hence, if there are, I don't know, 5 to 20 entries in a bin, that's enough. Typically, you probably have large amounts of data and there's tons. And so it's a completely Poisson distribution, and you can just take the square root. And there's a question saying, how do you assess when N is big enough to use the Poisson formula? Well, here are approximate numbers, Sylvia. The idea being that, well, all models are wrong, so is the Poissonian, but sometimes it's a very good approximation, hence we use it. In that case, again, computers are the best to answer that question. And that's actually today's exercise, you could say. When is it close enough? When does it match? So, and now you might say, that's all right, Troels. Come with an example. Well, how many people in Denmark venture into traffic a year? And so if you go out every day, you count 365. How many times do people do that in Denmark? The answer is quickly, I don't know, but it's large. It's probably a billion, right? 6 million times, a lot. It's in the billions. What is the chance of dying in traffic when you go out? Well, small. Usually we don't die when we go out. But when you multiply the two, it doesn't give zero either. It gives some number. And that's actually what you should expect for the number of deaths in traffic in Denmark. And the number used to be around 400. And that was easy, because what is the uncertainty in that number? Well, it's the square root of that number. It's 20. And that means that if they sit in the Ministry of Traffic and do all sorts of things and see that the number of deaths in traffic fall from 400 to 380 next year, they might celebrate because it's a drop. But when it's 420 the following year, they shouldn't be disturbed or anything. That's to be expected. It will jump up and down. How can you then know if it dropped? Well, you will have to see over some years. And well, it has dropped. And some years it goes up. And well, if there's a lot of ice on the roads, here you then get sort of a systematic uncertainty in. But actually, it's been following a slow trend going down. And it's not hard to fit, you know, exactly what uncertainty to assign to each of the points. And now you can follow what happens. And then you might say, Troels, but when I go on my motorbike drunk 200 kilometers per hour in the city, I think the probability of dying is slightly different than when I walk down in my slippers to the bakery on the same block and buy bread. And I'll concur with that. But the Poisson also has another, feature. If you have two Poisson numbers, one with lambda A and one with lambda B, then adding those up, you actually get a new Poisson distribution, which is just the sum of the two. You can see Barlow for the proof of that. And this means that you can easily add across categories of death, you could say, meaning that even if there is a variation in the probability, it will still give a Poisson distribution. And so for so many things, the Poisson distribution plays the central role. Any count, you could say. Whenever you encounter a number, you should ask, is there a high number behind it and a low probability? Then it's a Poisson number and the uncertainty is the square root of that number. And Steen asks, is the sum still one? Yes, if you take the sum of all these terms, and now it goes to infinity because you assume n to be an infinite. If you sum all that up, then it doesn't matter what lambda is, you get one. Yes, it's normalized. Now, what about, well, this law, I would say, has all, and Steen continues, also if you add to Poisson, yeah, it doesn't depend on lambda. So for every Poisson process you put into the big pile, it remains Poisson distributed. Just like in the central limit theorem, that if you have a Gaussian and you add another Gaussian number, then it remains Gaussian. It can't get more Gaussian. It converged. Now, this has immense implications. It's like a natural law just in statistics. And let me just ask you, and you can write in the text field, how many flight accidents leading to deaths are there a year in the world from commercial flights? And I don't mean things getting shot down, but if you're the aviation authority of the world and you want to minimize, of course, how many die in air traffic a year, you know, how many are we looking at? Give me a number. What's No. How many planes go down a year? All right, I get 10, 150, one or less, five, three, yeah. All right, I think the answer is not 100. It's much more like single digits, but it's not 0.01. We typically have a few a year. Where a plane goes down and somebody dies, right? And small, no, these were commercial aircrafts. Small airplanes do also go down, but people rarely die. Now, let's say that four go down a year. The uncertainty on that is two, which means that when the civil aviation authorities of the world unite and do everything they can to put down the number of accidents, how long is it gonna take before you know if all these actions have any impact? You don't need to write the answer. We know it's gonna take a long time, right? You might have to wait 50 years to see if you manage to decrease the number of planes going down. What can you do then? Are you lost? Will you never make civil aviation more safe? And the question was, if you have four planes going down and somebody dying from it a year in the world, and you as civil aviation authority improve on all sorts of safety measures, how can you know if that has an impact on the number of planes going down? Next year it's three, but then the year after it's five. And it could be that the mean went from four to three, but it will take you a long time to know that. The answer is that you completely change the way you do aviation. Well, ask, it doesn't help stop binning in years. It's still too low statistics and too high uncertainty to solve it. The answer is that instead of looking at planes going down, then you know from planes going down that either there was a mechanical failure or a control failure or so on. And suddenly you start monitoring how many mechanical failures and how many control failures and how many other failures, because most of these don't lead to any plane going down, crashing down. But if you know the number of mechanical failures go down, then you know that civil aviation gets more safe. There are tens of thousands of mechanical failures on aircrafts a year, I can tell you. But the problem is now making sure that this is reported. And this is where in aviation, law has changed completely. Nobody gets fired from having a near miss and, you know, taking poor decisions. But people get fired if they don't report them. And mechanics gets fired if they don't report them. Of course, if you show up drunk, then surely you will get fired no matter if you have an incident or not. But the change in policy is the one that leads to getting information about all the near failures, the near misses. And from that, you have tens of thousands. And now you can see if all your routines, new legislation, so on, has an effect. And this has changed aviation completely. And my prediction is that it will change the way we do health. Because when doctors operate, well, one in a thousand, even for an appendix, is gonna go wrong. It's not because the doctor is stupid or anything. Well, again, if the doctor's drunk, you're out. But it happens, and you have to be open about that it happens. But you also have to monitor it, and you need to get statistics behind it. And this change has come slowly, and it's coming slowly to so many places because they realize that the law, the Poisson law that's written on the screen right now, you cannot battle that. It's like the natural law of statistics, or one of them. There's nothing to get around there. You just have to take the smart choices that leads to you being able to even see if you're improving things. So please remember, the error on a Poisson number is the square root of that number. And there is a question. So if the mechanism is changed, so the distribution could change. Yeah, the probability should hopefully go down, and hence the number of cases should go down with it. The thing is just if you can monitor it. And another question, in the airplane example, wouldn't you look at the historical data spread, not the square root of an average? No, because historically, more planes used to go down or a larger fraction, because aviation has gone up, but the number of planes going down has not. And so, and it's too small statistics to do anything clever about. All right, on that note, we'll move on to the Gaussian. And then you might say, but we've already had the Gaussian. Yeah. Here, I just want to say that, well, in the case of lambda going to infinity and many other cases in PDFs, and here lambda for 20 is enough, the Poisson converges towards the Gaussian. So, and well, you might say, but the Poisson distribution is not symmetric. How can it converge towards a Gaussian? Well, let's just take an example. Now I just take lambda 20, which I hope you'll agree is not a super high number. Here's a comparison of the two. And true, the Poisson is slightly shifted. But when I draw a Gaussian next to it, and of course I choose the mean to be the same, and I also choose the width of the Gaussian to be the Poisson, namely square root of 20, then I get this. Of course, in the tails, it's different, right? Here on a log scale, you do see that the Poisson dies faster here and has a longer tail out higher. But the approximation is quite good. And as lambda increases, it gets very good. This gets us to a point that we will use tomorrow. Let's say that you have 20 entries in a histogram. One of the bins has 20 entries. What error do you assign it? Well, square root of 20, and you assume it to be Gaussian. but in reality, it's Poisson. For 20, I would say that's a good approximation. But what if the number of entries in a bin is 4? Well, now you have 4 plus minus 2. It's drawn here in green. And well, the approximation to a Gaussian is, shall we say, less good. Which means that if you assign to a bin 4 plus minus 2, then you're making an approximation, right? Because it's not quite Gaussian plus minus two. It's actually Poisson distributed. The chi-square can't do anything about that. In the chi-square, we just divide by sigma, and that's the Gaussian sigma, and there's nothing to do about it. Which means that the chi-square, when there's low statistics, makes approximations. Now, the chi-square is robust, but it's still an approximation. And so for low statistics, you actually run into troubles. And you especially run into troubles if things are far away from the mean. Here, if you have a bin where you expect 20, but you suddenly observe only 5, well, then you're a factor off, right? And so for that reason, tomorrow we'll look at the likelihood, which actually does not have to assume a Gaussian uncertainty when you fit a histogram. So it's not needed. So that's the great thing about the likelihood. The bad thing is you don't get a chi-square and a probability value out. You just get some number, which is more or less arbitrary. We'll return to that. And so we're back at the Gaussian, which well, plays the central role. And Pearson, yes, the Pearson behind the Pearson correlation says, the more huge the mob and the greater the apparent anarchy, the more perfect its sway. And that's of course because of the central limit theorem, that you get more and more Gaussian the more you mix into it. And that's actually what happens to the Poisson. The more you have infinite numbers of people venturing into traffic and a lot of small probabilities that you add up, and that gives something Gaussian. And again, we try to memorize the 1, 2, and 3 sigma limits, namely 2/3 is inside, 95 inside, and 99.7, or rather 1/3 outside, 5% outside, and 3 per mil. 5 sigma is a larger number. And then finally, I want to mention students' t distribution. Well, the students' t distribution you can see here. And first, let's look at the number of degrees of freedom infinite. Well, in that case, it's the Gaussian. It converges towards the Gaussian. Here's actually the expression. You're welcome to try to prove that this converges towards the Gaussian when nu goes to infinity. And what are the others then? Well, the others are that a Gaussian comes out when you know the mean, and you know the uncertainty, the standard deviation of the sample. But in the student's case, you might say, but well, I have an estimate of the mean, or I might even know the mean, but I don't know the sample uncertainty because I only made 4 measurements. And hence, I have 3 degrees of freedom because I estimate the mean. Now, then your measurements should be compared to a student t distribution with 3 degrees of freedom. And that means that when you have few measurements, then you might say, okay, the chance of getting some outlier, how big is that? Well, it's bigger. You see, the tails are fatter. And that's because with 4 measurements, it might be that 3 of the measurements are by chance very close to each other, and 1/4 measurement is a little away. And when you calculate the standard deviation of that, well, the 3 are going to count quite a bit with only contributing a small number, and the 4th one is going to look like it's far away. Well, that is expected because if you put in the true variance, or the true sigma of the problem, it would probably be bigger. You were just unlucky. And that's what this takes into account. And I can say that you might say, why is it called student? Well, that's because it was invented by William Gossett. And William Gossett was Irish, and he worked for a certain Irish brewery that starts with a G and end on Guinness. And he was doing quality inspections of the beer. And for that, he did, you know, a few samples and then realized, hey, it doesn't quite fit the Gaussian because I only have a small sample. So he then did the math and came up with the, well, this distribution. But Guinness thought this a company secret, how to do this properly. And so he wasn't allowed to publish. But then he published anonymously, signing just student. And people realized that this was an important distribution, and hence it came to be named Student's Tea Distribution. I would say that mostly we just deal with the Gaussian, but I want you to know that the Student's Tea Distribution exists. And if you have an important case where you only have a few measurements, that happens often also in your theses and so on, do take a consideration of the Student's Tea Distribution, because maybe you get a small p-value, but in reality, one of the outliers is not that much of an outlier. And you'd rather note that yourself than having the sensor asking you. All right. And then Nicolay asks, in practice, wouldn't we use students' tea distribution most of the time? How often do we really know the true variance? The answer is we don't know the true variance very often because we do measurements. And so in principle, you're right, Nicolay. But notice with 5 degrees of freedom, how close the blue is to the black. Now that's still a low number, and here I would probably still consider using Student's Tea Distribution, but when N is just 20, I think you will not be able in the graphs here to see the difference between 20 and infinity. And so that is why we don't use it that often. And there's also a limit to how many requirements I want to pour on you when solving problems. Just the line of thinking with how many sigmas are we away with a Gaussian is a good line of thinking and often a good approximation. All right. Any questions or comments? No?
Okay, maybe I can come with one. How about, so how important is it, or like, how do we know when we need to use the student distributions instead of a Gaussian?
Simply from the number of measurements that goes into it, which when few, I would say 5 or below, it's probably good to consider. If many, 20, in statistics, 20 is typically a lot. Then I would not consider it at all. And I would say, actually in statistics, yeah, there's a few, 1, 2, 3, 4, which is always a troublesome case. There is many, which is 20. And then there is many for machine learning purposes where 100,000 is just enough. There are sort of 3 scales in statistics. Yeah, that was a very approximate rule, but okay. I don't see more in the chat. Then let's just quickly jump to today's exercise and then, there's a question. So the rationale for Poisson was the computation of factorial. What's the motivation for Gaussian instead of Poisson? Well, I would say yes, the motivation was also computational, but there's a lot of problems like the traffic one where you don't know N or P. You just know that when you multiply, you get a fixed number, and that's the theoretical idea behind it. Now, what's the motivation of the Gaussian instead of the Poisson? Well, the Gaussian is always motivated by the fact that all distributions, almost, tend towards the Gaussian when you reach some or another limit. So the Gaussian, I would say, is the primary motivation, and you should always ask yourself, what's my motivation for moving away from the Gaussian? And well, if lambda is small and it's a Poisson process, well, then remember the Gaussian is not discrete by construction. You can just make it discrete if you want, integrate over, you know, each bin width one. Yeah. Okay, cool. And again, you're more than welcome to sit and think about it, reach out for Barlow or some of the other books and see what they say. Look at today's problem, and then for the exercises, you can ask again. Just write down questions and don't hesitate in asking. Well, then I don't know if we should have a short look at today's exercise. Let me just introduce it. So today's exercise is, well, not surprisingly, about playing around with the binomial and the Poisson and the Gaussian distributions and seeing, actually answering or getting yourself the applied feeling, namely, when is lambda small or big, or how good of an approximation is it, and can I fit and fix these things? And if you feel that today's exercise is slightly short, I don't think it's that long, well, then don't hesitate to have a look at the student's T distribution and ask yourself, what would you do if you had four or five measurements where one was a little away? You know, can you first with a Gaussian evaluate if it's far away and afterwards with the student T distribution? Yeah, and yeah, and finally, I would say if you, well, want to have fun, is perhaps pushing it a little here, but have a look at the list of PDFs there exists, just sort of to get a feel. We will touch upon a few more during the course, but I think you have 90% of the use covered in the short list of 9 of them, of which I showed. Cool. That's it then. See you for the exercises.